We've all had fierce and formidable women in our lives who have shaped who we are now. The Tech and Learning's Honor Roll podcast is dedicated to celebrating women who have shaped the education landscape more than you can possibly imagine. Who better to host this conversation than Drs. Keisha Ray and Frances Gibson, two fierce and formidable women who have been driving innovation in the field of the education world for more than 30 years. Please welcome our hosts, Drs. Keisha Ray and Frances Gibson.
Welcome, everyone, to episode number 2 of Tech and Learning's Honor Roll, a podcast that celebrates fierce and formidable women in education. I'm Keisha Ray.
And I'm Frances Gibson, and we're so happy you could join us today. We have another fierce and formidable female joining, and that is Dr. Deborah Duardo. We're going to traverse the landscape from dropouts to diplomas. So just who is Deborah Duardo? Dr. Duardo was appointed the Los Angeles County Superintendent of Schools by the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors effective May 15, 2016. This designated her as the top education leader of the nation's most populous and diverse county. In this post, Dr. Duardo provides leadership and support to the superintendent, another top administrator of the county's 80 K-12 school districts. She has more than 30 years of professional experience in working with at-promise students and their families. Her unique life experience as a high school dropout, able to overcome obstacles and rise to the position of county superintendent, drives her passion to ensure that all students receive an education in a safe, caring environment, and that every student is college prepared and career ready. She holds a master's degree in social work from the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, and a doctorate from UCLA's Graduate School of Education and Information Studies.
Oh my goodness. She is definitely one of our sheroes in education, and we are so fortunate to explore models of leadership together with her. From what our guests see in the mirror, in other words, reflections of themselves, mentors that have impacted them. And with this in mind, we will turn to the movements we should all be watching and getting ready for maverick moments. That's right, my friends, you're seeing a pattern of M.
And you know, Keisha, we also want to be conscious of this thing called edge babbling, the use of words that we use in our field. And so to ensure that our listeners know exactly what's being said and add some new vocabulary and phrases to their nomenclature, I caught one while I was introducing Deborah, this concept or idea or language around at promise. Deborah, help us out. Can you help us define what is this at promise idea?
Well, the idea of at promise is really looking at children through their assets and a belief that they can accomplish anything that they want to accomplish, regardless of the circumstances under which they're living. That could be poverty, that could be homelessness, that could be being behind on credits, maybe not having the resources in their home or their community to do well in school. We don't believe that any child should be referred to in a negative term. In the past, people would refer to these children as at risk. And what was really disappointing to me is I started hearing children refer to themselves, well, I'm an at-risk kid from an at-risk household. And it really was kind of getting them to see themselves as deficit somehow, rather than seeing it doesn't matter where you start off in life. If you have the right resources and support, you can be anything that you want.
Wow, Deborah, thanks for that incredible definition, and so powerful for a child to hear that message. I'm sure every one of our listeners now appreciates that phrase and will hopefully be using it in their own communities. So let's start with the first M models. Who might you say your role models are and why?
So I have a lot of role models. I'll start to say that people that are role models to me are people that have had to experience hardship and challenge and have been able to overcome those challenges. Those type of people that overcome obstacles are role models to me, as well as many people who may not have had similar challenges, but people that are working really hard for social justice, for equity, people that are willing to you know, question the status quo, people that are willing to look at systems and systemic racism or discrimination. You know, if I were to name a few, I would say Justice RBG. I would say another Michelle Obama, our former First Lady. People who just do are passionate about the work that they're doing and are trying to create a change for the better in our world, in our communities.
Lots of powerful women that you're evoking into our mind as we think about this. And I know that you've been surrounded by so many phenomenal mentors as you think about your journey in education. So share with us a little bit, who have been some of those key mentors that have been side by side with you, and how have they mentored you along the journey?
Well, I have to start off by saying one of my strongest mentors was not a person in education. That person, Patty Giggins, is the executive director of Peace Over Violence. And I actually worked for her for 10 years when it used to be the LA Commission on Assaults Against Women. I was a high school dropout, and Patty Giggins hired me to lead an effort on child abuse prevention. And she taught me so much. And I think working in the nonprofit world, you really realize how to make do with very little. And you have to be the person that's doing outreach. You have to be the person that's doing fundraising. You have to be the person that's running your program. She was a strong model, an incredible feminist, and really taught me that women can be very successful. And she didn't care that I didn't have a high school diploma.
Oh my goodness, that's so powerful. You know, when did you look in the mirror and know that you were a leader? What did you see in your mirror?
I can't say that I ever looked in the mirror and said, hey girl, you're a leader. You know,
we all did.
We're saying it for you.
All right. I think, you know, when I started to really, you know, early in life, I would say in junior high school, I was in student council. I was always organizing and thinking about how I can make things better. When I started to work in education, even though I started off as a counselor, it seemed like I was always attracted to more systems work and creating better systems. And so I was just always tapped on the shoulder like, hey, why don't you do this? And was very motivated to see change. So I don't think I looked in the mirror and said, hey, you're a leader. But I did notice that people turned to me, and I did notice that I inspired other people. And I did realize that by inspiring other people, I could create the change that I was working really hard to implement.
Yeah, that inspiration comes across clearly. And as we think about it, it's really this concept of movement. So folks are moving with you. And we also see lots of movements happening, not only locally, but across the globe. And it reminds us of another social justice leader that I know is dear to your heart. MLK said, a social movement that only moves people is merely a revolt. A movement that changes both people and institutions is a revolution. And you're leading one of the largest institutions in one of the most diverse counties with the most amount of school districts. So how are you leading that change as a woman? And what do you think are some movements we should be looking at?
Well, I think there's right now in particular a very strong movement, and it's not a new movement. It's that movement of civil rights and social justice. And, you know, we've experienced some real blatant acts of racism and discrimination. You know, we can look at the murders, whether it's George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, you know, and I think it has stirred emotion in not only the African American community or other minorities, but I think everybody of every color, of every gender, you know, is saying that this is just not acceptable. And I think, you know, looking at equity, looking at social justice, making sure that everybody has access to their civil rights. You know, for us, we're focusing very much on students in education. But, you know, even before you get to school, how you live in the world and the experiences that you have an impact on whether or not you're able to succeed in school. So we know that children who are experiencing homelessness or living in poverty, or children who don't have access to quality healthcare or to early childhood education, that by the time they first step into a school classroom, they have already experienced a great deal of experiences that impact their ability to learn.
Oh, that's so true. And you know, you mentioned, you know, the movements that we're seeing right now. And we've had these movements at different periods in history, right? And unfortunately, we don't seem to have gotten the progress that we should have made, especially by 2021. So who are you watching that's out there as a maverick, if you will, that's really doing some great work around disturbing the system and that we should all be paying attention to?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is I joined a group, and it's not one person. Mm-hmm. It's a task force that was brought together by a group of philanthropists to look at the disparity in this COVID environment in terms of how people are disproportionately impacted. So it's really a group of all sectors. It's leaders in education, it's leaders in ensuring everybody has a home, it's the business community, it's the nonprofit world, it's the health field. And we came together to look at, as I said, disparities of how the COVID is impacting folks. In the middle of that, we had the murder of George Floyd. And, you know, then we started saying, well, it's beyond, you know, just looking at COVID. It's putting a spotlight on this huge issue of racial discrimination and more specifically anti-Black discrimination. And so I've been working with a group of leaders from different sectors to say, we don't want to go back to the old LA. There were a lot of challenges prior to this pandemic that we really need to take a closer look at. And we've worked on a report. It's the No Going Back LA report that really gives some specific recommendations on things that we need to do to eradicate the social injustices that we see that impact many people of color and people that live in poverty.
So really addressing how we take care of one another in our community, and also lessons for the larger community outside the school system. And as you think about how you take care of others, we're going to transition to some space around how you take care of yourself. And I know as a trained social worker, you know a lot about self-care practices. And I know sitting with you over the years, I've always attended to your words of wisdom around how we really do need to take care of one another, both personally and professionally. There's so much to manage as a mother and as a grandmother and as a leader, and you've lived all of these roles simultaneously. In fact, I want to read to you something that your alma mater wrote about you. They said, while she has reason to be amazed at her personal and professional journey, Duardo is happiest among something that won't earn her a plaque. She said, I raised 4 amazing human beings who are following their love, she said. They are good people who are very social and justice conscious. Wonder where that comes from. And again, you have journeyed as a leader while being a mother. And we want to know, how do you manage it all? What are your self-care practices? And what would you advise other women leaders and nurturers?
Yeah, so now more than ever, we really need to think about practicing self-care. You know, this pandemic has put a real highlight on mental health, on, you know, everybody being stressed by the fact that our whole lives have been disrupted, right? For me, I've been an avid meditator. I've done transcendental meditation for over 30 years before it was trendy. So I meditate twice a day for 20 minutes a day. I think that for me, it gives me the ability to stay calm, to focus myself and to not let the small stuff, you know, drive me crazy. And I think everybody has to find whatever works for them, whether it's meditation or music or dance or sports, you know, going to the gym. I think it's just critical that people find a way. You know, finding a balance is really important. And you know, it's kind of a hard question to answer when people ask someone that has, you know, children, a huge job, a lot of responsibility, how do you find a balance? And, you know, I don't know if there's anything that really is an actual balance. You know, some days it might be 90% I'm focusing on, you know, my job and the critical work that's taking place right now. And my family's only getting 10% of me, you know, but overall, I try to make sure that I have time for everything. And even if some days it's more, you know, disproportionate, that's okay. As long as I know that my family is a priority, that I have to make sure that I'm, you know, talking to my spouse and my children and staying true to them. And at the same time, not letting anything drop in terms of my responsibilities and obligations as the county superintendent.
Those are incredible words of wisdom. I recently became a mom in my retirement years.
Congratulations.
Super long story, but she is my very first baby. And I retired from being a soup and had her, and it changed my entire world. So I want to ask you a question. I want to ask you to finish this sentence. An event that changed my worldview is?
I think an event that changed my worldview was becoming a parent. I became a parent when I was 16 years old. And I gave birth to a child with a severe disability. Bruce was born with spina bifida. And, you know, as soon as he was born, he was rushed to Children's Hospital. He had to have an operation to close his spine. He had 10 operations the first year of his life. I had no idea, you know, how I was going to be a good parent. I didn't understand what the medical profession and the social workers were communicating to me. And I realized that my whole world was going to change, and having to really understand his disability and understand that if I was going to be a good parent to him, I would really have to go back to school, get an education, learn how to advocate for him. And that becoming a parent and that responsibility, coupled with him having a very severe disability, really changed my whole outlook on life, my priorities. You know, I don't take things for granted. When I see a child taking their first step, to me, it's a miracle. It isn't something that everybody does. And so it really taught me to prioritize things in my life and to really have a lot of gratitude and appreciation for when things do go right.
That's such a story of strength personally. And we're also wondering, what's something that you became stronger around in your professional career? What's an event that you might want to reflect back on and have others consider that helped you with your strength?
I think the things that make you stronger are the challenges that you face both personally and professionally. And, you know, there's that, you know, true saying that that which doesn't kill you only makes you stronger. And as you experience hardship and as you learn how to overcome that hardship, you start to have more confidence in your ability to problem solve, to move forward. And I think that it's those experiences. So for me, having been a high school dropout, really taught me a lot in terms of how I relate to parents. It taught me a lot about how I relate to students, my belief that you don't give up on children, that you don't give up on anyone, that everybody deserves a second chance, and that, you know, when I interact and when I make decisions based on what I think is best for students. And having had that experience growing up in poverty, being Latina, having parents who didn't understand the educational system here, and yet being able to come back, you know, even with four children, coming back to school, you know, going to UCLA with children and a son who was medically fragile, I learned that I could do this. And the same thing in my career. Every time I faced something that I thought was just impossible to overcome, whether it was improving the graduation rates when I was at LAUSD or creating partnerships that had never existed to leverage resources that would ultimately impact children. All of those experiences made me a stronger person and more capable to take on the next challenge.
Well, I have one more challenge for you. Finish this sentence. My life improved when I...
When I completed my education, I was given the tools that I needed to get a good job. You can't get a job if you don't have that degree. But having the degree gave me the opportunity to pick a career that I loved, to be able to improve lives, to change. When you're an educator, you have the ability to change the trajectory of someone's life. You know, sometimes you're planting seeds here and there, and sometimes you're so fortunate when you get to see those changes actually happening. And I have many former students that I've worked with that have kept in touch with me, have followed my path either into social work or into education. And there's nothing more rewarding than that, is to really be able to have that kind of an impact on not just one person, but many, many people's lives.
You have certainly planted many seeds even in this conversation with us today that we hope we will continue to grow. And so as we think about this growing, Keisha, I know I've learned a lot, and I'm curious, what have you been learning from this conversation with Dr. Duardo?
Well, I mean, not only have I learned the amazing and incredible gift that she is to the field of education, but I've also learned that the children in LA County have an impeccable advocate at the helm who is making sure that they have the opportunity for promise. They have the opportunity for hope for future. I don't think there's any child in that county that should feel that they can't aspire to be a bigger, better person than they are today when they look in the mirror. And that's in great part because of you and your leadership and what you do to inspire those who you serve. So thank you for that. And thank you for going back to school. I know that took a big lift, and especially with a child and who was medically fragile. And thank you for taking that leap and doing that, because without that, we wouldn't have you here with us today, and the kids in LA County wouldn't have you being such a tremendous advocate for them. So thank you so much. And I have one final question for you. Is there anything that you want to share that we didn't ask you or you didn't think about as you were kind of answering questions that you'd like to share now with our audience?
I think the other thing to really think about when you're in education is how we work with parents. I think parents are such a critical part of what we do to support children. And, you know, having raised children, I know how difficult it is to be a parent. And I know the sacrifices that parents are making. I think we have to really learn to listen to parents and students, and we have to find ways to empower them to be able to advocate for what they need. Oftentimes as educators or leaders, we think that we know what's best. And, you know, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we need to listen to what a parent or a student is telling us and make sure that we're empowering them to advocate for what they need, and that we're actually listening to what they say and following up on supporting them in ways that they find would actually be helpful. So I just want to say that part of empowering others, the people that you're serving, and to treat them well, and to really believe that they know what's best for them, and that they need guidance and support in certain areas, but they are the experts when it comes to what's going on in their lives and what they need in order to move forward.
So true.
Strong reminders of empowerment and advocacy, from the classroom to the boardroom to the living rooms where our families are at, and really ensuring that we're listening to all students. And you started at the very beginning about putting that student at the center when we thought about our At Promise students. And we're going to ask our listeners to think with this coaching question in mind and join us with, how might you use your leadership wisdom skills to help At Promise students in your community? And so we hope that you'll join us in answering that question as we think about words of wisdom from today's presenter. And Keisha, what's next?
Well, I want to remind everybody on that coaching question to respond through Twitter with the hashtag TL Honor Roll, roll spelled R-O-L-E. And so we can kind of track what your thinking is after you've listened to this podcast. We can't thank Deborah enough for joining us today and spending a little bit of time with us sharing her story and her wisdom.
Indeed. And we want you to know that we appreciate you and appreciate our fierce listeners who will lead with your message of love leadership for At Promise learners.
Please join us for our next podcast where we will highlight another Shero in education. Don't forget to follow our hashtag TL Honor Roll, R-O-L-E. And until then,
be fierce
and be formidable.
The Tech and Learning's Honor Roll podcast is produced by Keisha Ray, Francis Gibson, and Christine Weiser. Audio production by Mitchell Tulin and AV Nation. Tech and Learning's Honor Roll theme music is by Madison Van Gundy. Find more episodes on techlearning.com and follow us at hashtag TL Honor Roll. That's TL Honor, R-O-L-E.